Welcome back to another episode of Office Hours. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by Ashwin Kamlani, the CEO and co-founder of Juicer. It's an incredible startup that's revolutionizing the restaurant pricing industry. But his story didn't start there. Ashwin actually started by negotiating his way into an unpaid internship at Meliá Hotels, then took a leap of faith into his first startup after a chance meeting with an entrepreneur. And his career overall has been one of bold risks, pivots, and truly staying true to himself. We're going to talk about the lessons he learned from running a company while also driving an Uber to keep it afloat, what it means to be a transparent leader in today's world, and how his 12-year-old daughter is now road tripping across the country with him in their pink polka dot RV to meet clients and bond along the way. If you're ready for an amazing story about authenticity, persistence, and a little bit of crazy in the best way, you're in the right place. Let's dive in. Thank you so much for doing this with me and for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Ashwin, I would love to jump right in and just kind of start at the very beginning of your career. I want to start specifically at Meliá because it seems like that has been an interesting part of your career that you care a lot about. And so I'd love to kind of jump in and start from there.
Sure. That's great. I mean, I had spent 3 years in New York doing the typical kind of tech consulting thing, but found it very unfulfilling. But it certainly taught me how to work hard and work long hours. But it wasn't until I got to Meliá that I felt really passionate about my work. I went to Cornell to get my master's in the hotel industry, even though I had never worked a day in the hotel industry. They were kind enough to open the doors to me. And that's really when I got involved with Meliá.
Now, you started out, though, originally as an intern and grew into a global VP into that e-commerce role. How did that transition happen?
Well, so the first week, Cornell, September 11th happened, and they shut down everything. It was the hotels were laying people off, and so they canceled all the internship programs. And they said, okay, well, nobody's getting an internship. I don't know if anybody else in my class did an internship, but I was like, no way, I'm not giving up this opportunity to get an internship. So I just relentlessly went after Meliá. I was like, I'm going to find a way into this company. And long story short, I eventually got in touch with somebody. And I just had to say, listen, I'm at Cornell. I'm doing my master's here. I understand the situation. So you don't have to pay me a penny. I've got 4 weeks off during Christmas time. I will pay for my own flight. Just let me go work somewhere. And so this gentleman who I'm still in touch with today, his name is Manuel. And he just said, well, why would I say no? You know, so we just opened this brand new resort down in the Riviera Maya in the Cancun area. It's empty because, you know, the pre-opening budget's been canceled. Nobody's traveling. So just go down there and work with the general manager and see what happens. And it was great because even though I was unpaid, I was able to help them dabble in e-commerce and get signed up with some OTAs. And this is what really vaulted my career at Meliá. And then, you know, one of the other VPs from Miami came down to meet with me and he said, you know, you need to join us. And so I went from this unpaid internship to finishing Cornell. I became the director of e-commerce in Miami.
Given that you spent, you know, so much of your early days of your career building, in, especially in the hospitality industry, growing and building at Meliá, do you mind walking me through what the e-commerce side of the business looked like for you? Because e-commerce then could mean something very different now.
So when I joined the Americas offices in Miami, they had nothing. They had a corporate website, which was solmeliá.com at the time. And I think they only had a Spanish version and an English version, if I remember correctly. And their most popular brands in the US, I mean, Sol, nobody had ever heard of. It was really in Mallorca and in the beaches of Spain. But their website was called solmeliá.com. Now, they had this new resort brand, all-inclusive, called Paradisus. And so one of the first things I noticed was, well, people would be searching for Paradisus in Cancun and not find it because the website was called solmeliá.com, and no American is going to make that connection. So we started to build micro sites for each resort. And then we built a brand site for Paradisus. And that right away started to escalate the interest and the bookings and the direct conversions. And of course, we built a US version of the site, started to work with different online media to bring in the right qualified traffic and audience. I started working with TripAdvisor, you know, all these different things. I also started policing pirates that were using fake domain names. You know, there were travel agencies and wholesalers pretending to be the official website and stealing our direct business because the company had just ignored it. And so there was a ton to clean up. So it was everything about the direct conversion. So getting the user experience, the digital marketing, the pricing, the promotions, the revenue management, the loyalty, running the call center, all of that ended up being under my purview. And frankly, we took the business from zero to, I think it was like 40 million euros in just a couple of years. And so that's when, you know, the corporate office was seeing everything we were doing and saying, you know, we need more of that here in the corporate office. And they asked me to go over to Spain.
And at what point were you asked to present to the chairman, Amelia?
So I think that was within the first year of my working at the company. Maybe it was the second year. I can't remember. But I was really nervous. I think it was in the Dominican Republic. And the chairman, you know, the founder of the company, who's now retired and his son runs the business. And his son was there too, Gabriel Jr. They invited me to come down to Punta Cana in a big resort and do a presentation about e-commerce. And I remember that I got up in front of them and told them, listen, we're missing a big opportunity. This is what we should be doing. And if we were to do these things better, we would be making a lot more money. And I remember everybody around the room, this was like a very serious meeting. Everyone was in suits and ties. And everybody kind of looked at me like in shock, because that wasn't really common to do that. You know, the other people before me had gotten up and presented, look at all the trade shows we're going to, and look at all the travel agencies we visited, and, you know, here are all the whatever. I mean, it was all kind of very activity-based reporting, don't worry, we're doing our job kind of thing. And I got up there and saying, listen, we are missing the boat. And, you know, so, you know, I was the first or second year of my career. And right after the presentation, the son of the founder took me aside and said, you know, listen, I really appreciate that you were honest and that you told us the problems and what needed to be solved. And so here's my email address. Here's my phone number. I want you to quietly keep in touch with me. Tell me what you think we should be doing, and I'll try to help you get whatever you need to be successful. And let me know every once in a while how things are going. And so it was amazing. And I felt like this is the way to be successful. And, you know, I should just always be open and transparent and not hide the good and the bad. And look, this was the result. And so that has served me extremely well, not only at Melia, but in the years to be.
You know, we've talked in the past and even just today about how being true to yourself is very important in business and, of course, entrepreneurship. How would you describe yourself to someone that you're just meeting or even sharing with us today? How have you kind of embraced that in business now?
You know, I have a difficult time separating my personal life and my business life and who I am from the way I am at work. Like, I'm just the one person, right? I don't have two or three sides. And so sometimes that can be challenging because I take things very personally. Like, I take my work very personally. I get very emotional about it. That's how I approach life and business. Not everyone's always comfortable with that, you know, and sometimes my approach to things can be unconventional. It can be not the way a typical person or corporate entity might approach things, or sometimes that makes people uncomfortable. But I can just say that I think the industry I'm in, both in hotels, you know, I ran my own business in the hotel industry, and we built a reservation system. We were mostly working with companies in Mexico and the Caribbean, and I was constantly told by people that my approach to business was very appreciated, and it built a lot of trust, and that caused them to go refer us to other people. And so again, that validated for me that this is a good way to do business. I've also been told by mentors, like, people do business with people they like. People do business with people they trust. You can have the best product out there, but if people don't like you or they don't trust you, then they're not going to buy it. And, you know, I've continued that here in the restaurant industry. The way I said that, it almost sounds intentional, but I don't know another way. And it has really worked well. And people in the restaurant industry have said, wow, it's so refreshing. You know, that you get online and you get on LinkedIn and you talk about the good and the bad. Not a lot of companies do that. It's usually all a bunch of smoke and mirrors and everything's amazing and it's all rocket ship. And so that, I believe, builds trust and people know I'm not hiding things, and that gives them confidence to work with us.
I know that was probably validated at Melia with just your authenticity. What was the reason that you decided to then pivot and join your first startup experience, but as CEO? Talk to me about that transition and how it transpired.
This is kind of a crazy story. So I had moved to Mallorca to take on this role with Melia, and I didn't know anybody there, and met this one gentleman who was a Danish entrepreneur, very smart and very energetic person. And I'll never forget, he said, so tell me what you do. And I said, oh, I run e-commerce and distribution for Melia Hotels and Resorts. And his eyes just lit up and he was like, I've always wanted to start an online business in the travel and hospitality sector. I want you to go in tomorrow, quit your job. I'll double your salary. I'm going to give you equity in the company, move to Miami. I'm going to put $2 million in the bank. and you just go hire your friends and run this company. And I was like, run that by me one more time. I mean, it was kind of like, is this really happening right now? And it was. I mean, that's this guy, you know, if you ever to meet him, that's how he operates. And that's what I did. Went in and I sat down with my boss at Melia and I said, listen, I'm really sorry, but I have this opportunity I just can't pass up. And so I moved back to Miami.
Was that like next day? Did you walk in the next day and do it? Or what was the timeline?
You know, it was pretty quick. It was pretty quick. I mean, I didn't have to think about it that much. I had been at Melia altogether for probably 7 years. Loved my job there. I loved the people there. But at the same time, I had recognized that I had developed a lot of knowledge around e-commerce and travel and hospitality. And I had never thought about going out and starting a business or being an entrepreneur. But when this gentleman kind of served it up to me on a silver platter, I was like, that could be really cool. And so, not to mention all the, you know, benefits that would come along with what he offered me. So I kind of couldn't say no. And so I did it. I moved back to Miami. He put the money in the bank. I hired a bunch of people. And it was a really interesting learning experience. I mean, the business did not succeed. And that's just because I think we started it without a real view or vision of what we wanted to build. He, you know, that's the way he was. He was like, he made lots of money and he just dabbles, right? Oh, let's just start something and see what happens. And I guess that's okay for some people. But after the 2 years, I felt a little bit carsick from like the ups and downs of let's try this and let's try that. But I certainly learned a lot about how to build a business, how to hire people, the challenges that come along with that. And so, you know, when we decided to shut the doors, I thought, oh, I should probably do this on my own now. And I had people around me that were saying, you know, you should do this and you should do that. And so I decided, okay, I'm going to start my business. And I remember very clearly at that point, I had some people close to me in my personal circle saying, are you sure that's a good idea? Like, didn't you just try that? And I said, well, that was different, right? That was somebody else's company and it was somebody else's ideas. I was just the executor, right? But what if it's my own company and my own ideas? I think it could go a lot better. And I still had people saying, maybe you should go find a real job, you know, the kind of thing. How long are you going to do that before you say it's not working? It's funny because as an entrepreneur, I'm sure I can see you smiling and nodding your head. So I think most people are very supportive and most people are like, yeah, go get them. You know, you can do it. There's always a few that are like, are you sure you want to do that? Anyway, I just blocked it out, went after it. And sure enough, you know, I had this idea to start up a booking engine company. It was 2010. There were dozens of others out there. And so people were like, no, it's a bad idea. There are already so many out there. I'm like, yeah, but they're all bad and they're all antiquated. And when I talk to hotels, they're frustrated with the old technology they have and they're trying to compete with the online travel agencies. Like, I think there's something here. So went out, built it. I had a really good group of technology partners. And it was like 3 months before we signed our first customer and started to bring in, you know, revenue. And we didn't take any investment. So it was all pure, you know, revenue for us. And I think we signed one hotel per month in the first year. By the end of the year, we had $100,000 in revenue from nothing. And so we were all like jumping up and down with excitement.
Yeah. So you decided to bootstrap it. Why did you decide to do that?
I didn't know any different. I mean, I guess I thought to myself, you know, if I can do this on my own, then I can call my own shots and I can run it the way I want and I don't have to. And particularly, I can do what I think is right for the business. So if I have a customer and I think the right thing to do is to give them a free system for a year just because of whatever reason, I can do that and I don't have to justify it to anyone. And that's the way I wanted to run the business. That was probably the primary driver. And I was very happy to do that. I have to tell you something else, which is now when I'm in here at Juicer, we do have institutional capital, but we have the right institutional capital. If I were to call up any of my larger investors and say, listen, you know, this large restaurant company, I think there's a huge opportunity there and I want to work for them for a certain amount of time because of XYZ, I would not just say, dude, you go for it. Now, you know, I think they trust my judgment and the way I'm doing things. And, you know, they've seen that it's worked for us. And I love that.
Yeah, it's so interesting, especially given that you've done now both sides of it. You started out experiencing it with capital and without. What made you decide, and we'll get to Juicer in a bit, but I'm curious while we're on the topic, what made you with Juicer decide to take in the capital?
So my first company, Regatta Travel Solutions, we definitely hit a wall at some point. And that's because we didn't raise the capital, then I couldn't go out and hire Salesforce. I was the Salesforce. We weren't able to afford the integrations like Opera. And that was very limiting for us in terms of the new customers and the new companies that we could acquire as customers. And so I got to a point where we had this really innovative solution, but the bigger players out there were starting to copy all the stuff we had built. And I couldn't steal their business or catch up to them because I hadn't raised the capital to build all these integrations and things like that. And so when I started Juicer with Drew Patterson, first of all, you know, Drew is the kind of guy that he was one of the founding members of Kayak. He has built and sold Room 77 and Transparent and, you know, Jet Setter. And so that's what he does. He's very well connected. So there was no doubt that we were going to build some kind of prototype or business, go out and raise a bunch of money and then go from there. And which was exciting for me because I didn't have the experience to go out and raise that kind of capital. And I'm thankful to Drew that he agreed to bring me on as a co-founder, despite that I didn't have that experience and scaling a business like that. But I think it's worked out really well for us. And yeah, it's a whole other ballgame when you have these type of institutional investors.
Truly. And to bring us back to Regatta for a moment, obviously at some point you decided that you hit a wall. What made you then decide, I know you were acquired, what made you to make that transition? Was it, were you approached? Did you decide, we're not going to be able to scale it past this? How did that transpire?
Okay, so at some point we had one very large customer at Regatta Travel Solutions, and that company went into some internal difficulty and had to split into two companies. And at some point we lost one of them. And so we hit, after 4 or 5 years of the business, we hit a difficult year where we started to plateau, and then we were able to recover the revenue. I remember I was driving for Uber and I was like renting rooms out in my house on Airbnb so that I could not pay myself, but pay everybody else. But we were able to recover that revenue within a year. And at the same time, we started to get approached by companies about an acquisition. One of the companies was originally called Vacation Roost, and they were rebranded as Leisure Link. And they approached us and said, hey, we love what you guys have built. It would be a really great combination for the vacation rental industry. And I got super excited because I thought, oh, I've been hearing so much about vacation rentals. That sounds like a great future. And luckily, one of my advisors looked at the numbers and was like, Ashwin, I see some red flags. I don't think you should be selling to these people. 6 months later, they went bankrupt. And I was this close to signing a deal to sell the business to them. Now, right toward the end of that whole situation, I was approached by another company. And I had to tell them, listen, I have a non-solicitation right now with Leisure Link. And so I can't even talk to you. But if that falls through, I'll reach back out to you. Well, a couple months later, I reached back out and said, hey, are you still interested? And they said, yeah, we're still interested. And I just knew in my heart, if we continue on this trajectory that we're on, we're going to start to go like this, because our customers are going to start to get picked off and we won't win new business. Like, we're going to just fizzle out. And so I knew that it was the right time to sell. And it was a question of, can we find a good opportunity and sell to the right person before it starts to look like we're declining? So it was a clear choice for me that was the best way I could ensure a future for Regatta and the shareholders, my employees at the time, by doing that. So that's really how it all transpired.
Now, with that acquisition, though, clearly at the forefront of your mind was, I assume, you intending of going and working at that company. Did you ever approach it as, I just want to sell the company and get out? Or did you truly want to go into the business that you're acquired from?
Both, actually. I did want to sell the business and, you know, have a good enough exit that I wouldn't have to worry about it anymore, but then go work for it, because I really liked the company and I believed in the vision of that company, you know, when they acquired us. So I ended up going to work there for 5 years, which is a lot longer than what most founders do after they sell the business. But the truth is, I really believed in the vision and I liked the company and I wanted to see it through.
And at what point did you decide, you know, this has been an amazing opportunity, but I need to step away? Why, after 5 years, was that the end of the road for you?
You know, when I joined that company, it was probably 40 people, and they had acquired several other companies, and I think they got to 600 people. And I started to feel like my ability to impact the future of the company and where it was going, and it was starting to diminish. And so that was my time to say, you know what, I miss being an entrepreneur. I miss having that kind of impact. Like, I need to go do something else. And I started looking for a job and had a really tough time finding one. I was applying for I was going through my network and applying through for things on LinkedIn, but I was applying for chief marketing officer roles, chief product officer roles, chief commercial officer roles. And every time I got on a phone with a recruiter, they asked, so how long have you been a chief product officer, or how long have you been a chief marketing officer? And I had to say, I kind of haven't been one. And they said, so why would I hire you? And well, the answer is, I had my own business. I was doing all those things. Well, that's not good enough. You know, you're a generalist, and we have 10 other people that have been a chief marketing or chief product officer for 10 years for big companies. Why would we hire you, right? And so it became very difficult to find a job, frankly. And at one point, I was just networking on LinkedIn, and I was browsing through LinkedIn, and I followed Dan Shapiro, who's the COO. And I remember the very first time he walked out of his house, looked into his phone, and just walked around his neighborhood and spoke into his phone for about a minute. And I just thought, that is so cool. I love the format. It feels very casual, but I love what he's saying. And I thought to myself, you know, I live in Rome at the time. I lived in Rome at the time. I said, I could totally do that. And so I started to do it. And immediately the feedback I got from my network back then, which was a lot smaller than it is now, was, you have to keep doing that. It's so cool. Like, I love what you're saying. And so I just kept doing it. And Dan was super nice. He and I started exchanging notes and giving tips on, you know, the videos. And apparently, I didn't know this, but he was kind of circulating my videos within LinkedIn. And at the same time, Drew Patterson had this idea that there was a need for dynamic pricing in restaurants now that there were digital menus. And he called up a friend of his at LinkedIn and said, hey, I need a CEO for this business. Do you know anyone? And she looked at his network and said, I see you're connected with Ashwin Kalani, and everybody at LinkedIn here has been talking about his videos. You should reach out to him. And that's how it all started. So because of that, that's how Drew and I reconnected, and that's how this business got started.
Well, as a consumer of your videos, I can attest that they're incredibly interesting to watch. And I remember from when you were living in Rome, you'd be walking around, obviously, some beautiful and incredible places, but also talking about very real conversations. And now it's obviously turned into conversations about Juicer and what you're doing at the business. So how do you feel that that part of the business has helped Juicer in any way?
That's a really good question, and it's hard to quantify. And sometimes that can be challenging. And I don't, again, it goes back to how we started this conversation. I don't intentionally do it so that it helps the business or expecting some kind of ROI. I just do it because it's who I am and I like doing it, and I can't imagine not doing it. And so, you know, the feedback I've gotten is that, again, it's the transparency that people appreciate. They don't get very often. And so I believe companies, we've built a certain amount of credibility and a reputation around that. So I would argue that has helped us tremendously and continues to help us. You know, I'm in an RV right now, driving around the United States and visiting companies all over the country, and they're following the journey. And I have people reaching out to me saying, hey, when you're in Charlotte, come visit us in our offices. And when you're in Denver. And so I really do think that, again, I can't quantify it. I just can tell you that it is absolutely, it has been a positive for me and the company. And right now my daughter's with me. It's been positive for her.
Yeah, you need to tell a little bit about this. So what are you driving around in? How long are you doing this for? And who are you doing it with? Everyone needs to hear this.
Okay. So this all started, I think it was in May, when I was at a trade show and I was walking around and I went to a founder of a restaurant tech company. And he had a medium-sized booth. And I said, how much did this booth cost you? Because we had never really sponsored anything, even though people approach us all the time about sponsorships. And he said, probably 80K. And my heart sank. And I was just like, you spent $80,000 for 3 days to have this little booth here? I mean, that's crazy. I could take half of that and go all over this country for months and visit all these restaurant companies. And I'd probably meet many more people than I would standing in this booth for 3 days. And I just said, you know what? Why don't I do that? I should just do that. And so that's how the idea started. And then I was talking to my family about it. And I said, you know, maybe I should get in an RV and like just drive around the country. And then this idea that my daughter would come with me. So my youngest daughter, quite adventurous, and she's quite social. She's also taken an interest in the business. And so I said, you know what, you should just come with me. And thankfully, my wife is equally crazy as I am. And she's like, that would be awesome. And you guys would have such a great time. And let's just get her a virtual school for 4 months. And she was very supportive of the idea. And, you know, here we are. So she's doing virtual school and we're in an RV We started in Atlanta about 3 weeks ago, and I set up a bunch of meetings in Atlanta with restaurant companies that I have never met with before. I've never seen at a conference before. But when I reached out to them and I said, you know, my outreach wasn't, hey, I'm flying into Atlanta. Can I have a meeting with you? No, it was, listen, I'm going to get in an RV with my daughter, and it's this pink polka dot RV with a unicorn on it. I'm driving around the country for 4 months visiting restaurant groups with my daughter. She's going to come to the meetings with me. I'm trying to show her how I'm building this business. Could you give us an hour? You'd have to be kind of a jerk to say no.
It's brilliant, I'll be honest. And you're forcing everyone to come join a meeting with you, because why would you not want to take part in this?
You know, whatever your motivation is, whether it's like, okay, I've got to see this, or, you know, yeah, I've been following this company, I'm interested in what they're doing, or, you know, how can I say no? Whatever it is, it has worked. And almost every company in Atlanta that I wanted to meet with was like, sure. And they just opened their doors and invited us in. You know, I'll just tell you, one of them, for example, was Chick-fil-A, which is a dream company to work with when you're in a position like ours. They were like, bring her in and we'll give her like free milkshakes and we'll bring a bunch of people. And it was just awesome. We went in and had lunch with the team, and it was just, you know, and it's funny because, you know, again, there are always naysayers out there, right? And one person was like, you know, is this really professional? And why don't you just fly in for your meeting? And I was like, do you think I would have gotten this kind of an entrance or an invitation to a company like Chick-fil-A if I wasn't doing this, right? And so, you know, it's interesting. It has really worked out well, and we're just at the beginning of this. I mean, we're in Dallas now for the next 2 weeks, and 3 weeks ago, I didn't have that much going on here in Dallas, but now we have back-to-back every day. We've got meetings, lunches, dinners, and it's because I think people are following us and the story and the company, and the whole thing together is causing people to reach out and say, you know what, this is a great story. We want to be a part of it. And so it's been like,
And you're going to be there for how long in total? Do you have a set end date or just?
Yeah, and the plan is to do this until Christmas time and then head back to Europe because my wife and my oldest daughter are back in Austria. So the plan is to continue doing this till about, you know, December 15th, 18th, and then unwrap the RV and return it back to the owner and then get on a plane and go spend the holidays, you know, all together as a family. So that's the plan.
So let me get this straight. You were the one that wrapped this RV. I was wondering how it got the unicorn design from it. Did you guys pick that out?
I don't know if you know this, but my family and I drive around in a pink polka dot Hello Kitty Prius. And we have driven this car for 12 years now. And it's driven around the U.S., well, mostly East Coast. But we shipped it over with us when we moved to Europe in 2018. So it's been all over France, all over Italy, all over Austria. We've driven it through Montenegro and Greece and Albania. And so it's been amazing to see people's reaction to it and how much attention it gets, and mostly the smiles that it puts on people's faces, depending on the culture. And so when this idea came up and we thought about wrapping the RV, you know, we had this debate. Well, should it be juicer branded colors or something else? And I thought, you know, I've some pretty relevant experience that pink with white polka dots and a cute icon has a pretty profound impact on people and they tend to pay attention to it. I think we should do that. And so that's what we went with. You know, the unicorn has obvious connotations to it. You know, that's what we're trying to build here. And it has been fascinating. A lot of people have come up to us and knocked on the window and said, are you guys giving away juice? Or like, why does it say juicer on the side of the, you know, and I have to explain to them, you know, well, the restaurant industry is going through a difficult time right now. You know, inflation is making business quite difficult, but yet consumers are upset with high prices. And so we're working with restaurant companies to try to find the right balance and to be fair and things like that. And so it's been interesting. I had in Atlanta, this gentleman came up to me. He's like, what is this juicer thing? And after I explained it to him, he's like, oh, I'm a VP for the Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, we hear all the time about how the restaurants are struggling with this balance between what consumers are willing to pay versus inflation and things like that. It's great. It's opened up a lot of conversation.
Well, I'll use that as a very interesting transition. Thank you for sharing that. But I want to also talk about juicer a bit. So can you share, obviously, you're targeting the pricing side of the restaurant industry. Can you talk to me about kind of how the transition between what juicer started as to what it is now? Because I know it's gone through a few iterations and it's very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, look, this is not unusual, or you won't find this surprising as an entrepreneur. But we knew where we wanted to go, but life and business doesn't always give you a clear path to get there, right? Or a straight path to get there. We recognized that there was a big opportunity in the restaurant space to bring a newer, more modern approach to revenue management. We just didn't know exactly how to get started. And when we went out and started talking to the restaurant industry about how they deal with pricing, it was clear to us that there was an opportunity with third-party delivery. So that means Uber Eats, DoorDash, and Grubhub. Most restaurants, no, I would say all restaurants, were not using a separate strategy for how to price in those channels. They were just taking their normal menu prices and marking it up a flat commission amount. So, oh, if Uber charges me 20%, I'll just mark everything up 20% just to offset the commission so I don't have to deal with it. Which is shocking to anybody in the hotel industry. They're like, wait a minute, you get to mark up your prices so you don't have to pay the commission? That's ridiculous. But that's how it has been traditionally in the restaurant space. Well, we decided that that's not really efficient and it's not very consumer friendly, and you could be making a lot more money with a better approach. So we developed a different approach to go per menu item, per channel, by day part, by location. And we had several restaurant companies say, here, just run my pricing for me because I don't have the people or the manpower to do it. And the results were fantastic. So we were able to raise a seed round, and this was going to be our first major stepping stone toward building that future vision. Well, then Wendy's came out and, hey, we're investing $8 million in digital menu boards because it's going to give us more flexibility and we'll be able to run more offers throughout the day, which is a form of dynamic pricing. And then the Nation's Restaurant News wrote an article, Wendy's to implement dynamic pricing by 2025. And then the New York Post took that headline and twisted it into Wendy's to implement Uber-style surge pricing by 2025. And then the whole internet blew up and Wendy's was publicly lynched for price gouging, for, you know, all kinds of stuff, right? And Burger King jumped on them and said, oh, you know, we're not interested in jacking up prices on our customers, or we're going to give away $1 Whoppers. And it just was like this tsunami of bad luck and bad press, right? And at first it was great for us because a lot of restaurant companies had heard of us and they had heard of what we were doing, but they were kind of saying, I don't know if this pricing thing is going to take off. We'll worry about it later. But when Wendy's blew up so much, I think a lot of restaurant companies were debating, how do we feel about this? You know, what side of the fence are we on? Maybe we should really understand how this works. And so we had companies reaching out to us saying, tell us what you're doing. How does this work? And we're really interested in learning more. And so that's right around when we were closing our seed round. And so it was all viewed as, this is great, good momentum, like this is going to take off now. But what we found was that it just scared a lot of companies away. And everybody still thought this is a great idea. It's logical. You know, you guys are doing the right thing. It makes total sense. But we don't want to do it. We don't want to be the next Wendy's. It's too scary. And so as a startup, you're burning a certain amount of capital per month to sustain your existing customer base, who are all thrilled with what you're doing and expanding out to all their locations, which is a great sign of validation. But if you have no visibility into when the industry is going to get comfortable with it, or you're going to gain broader adoption, you're forced to make a decision. Do you roll the dice and continue burning the capital in the hopes that in a quarter, in 2 quarters, in 3 quarters, your sales will start to ramp up again? Or do you just say, we got to pull the plug on this thing and revisit later? And I decided for the latter. Now that you know a little bit of what I went through with my own startup, and then a little bit of what I went through when I had money in the bank, and now we've got these great institutional investors, I felt like there is no way I'm going to roll the dice on this. No, I am not going to find myself in a position a year from now where we're running out of money. We haven't gotten enough people to sign up for this. Now I've got to go back out and ask for more funding, which I probably won't get because I haven't been able to prove that we could build a business. I was like, and it killed me because I had hired people who trusted me, who worked with me at Regatta, who worked with me at Kognitive, who, you know, came in early days of the business. How can I help? Volunteer their time. And here I had to call these people up and say, listen, I just can't take the risk that a year from now, we're going to run out of money. You have to go find them. They were all super understanding, but it did not make it any easier to have those conversations. Now, the good news is we had about a year ago started up a new product line. It was kind of a spin-off of our pricing solution because every time we were implementing prices, we were showing everybody how those prices compared to their competition locally at each store. And I had one major customer in the United States, one of the biggest, unfortunately, I'm not allowed to say who it is, but one of the biggest brands in the United States, who said to me a year ago, we're not going to do this dynamic pricing thing. But that intelligence about how our stores are positioned locally, that's gold. And if you can provide that to me with a lot more enhancements, like we'll pay for that. Like, how much would you pay for that? And it was interesting enough that I thought, okay, I can't ignore this. And luckily, I went down that path. Let me just tell you that I took one person from the business and said, listen, I don't know if this is going to grow into anything, and I don't want to distract anyone. So let's just do this. Now, let's come up with a proposal. Let's work with this company and see if we can get a deal done. And as soon as we got the deal done, then I went to the rest of the business and said, okay, this is going to be a thing now. And so, you know, I got everybody else involved. But I remember people saying to me, don't do this. This is a distraction. You know, just focus on this pricing thing. But look where we are today. You know, that is now our main source of business. Before we shut down pricing, that was 80% of our revenue. And now that is what we're going to be focusing on. And that will be the first real stepping stone toward the broader vision of this company. But these are the kinds of very difficult things you go through as an entrepreneur, right? And there are people from the outside that are going to say, don't do that. That's a mistake. That's a distraction. You shouldn't be, whatever. And I've prevented myself from going down other paths before, but this one was like a no-brainer. So anyway, long story short, it was the right thing to do.
You know, not to pivot on you, but I think it's relevant. I think, you know, when I asked you before this, someone that you really look up to or admire or learned from, you mentioned your dad. And I want to ask you a little bit more about him, because when I think of who I go to for advice, I similarly go to some specific people in my circle, but specifically my dad. So can you tell me a little bit more about why you said him?
Yes. So, you know, when you're growing up and you're little, I don't know that you really understand or comprehend what it is your parents do. I didn't really know exactly what he did, but he was in the real estate business. We lived in Miami, and then in 1986, the real estate business in Miami took a hit. And so we packed up, and I was 10 years old, and we moved to New York all of a sudden, and I was living in Long Island, and I didn't know why. But, you know, I later look back on life and think, that must have been really difficult for my dad to shut down our lives in Miami and pick up and move us all to New York. And he did that because he had a friend in New York that was in a different business, and he was able to just go do something else. And I remember when we first moved to New York, my dad opened up a jewelry store in New Jersey, and that did very well. And then he ended up starting a clothing business in New York, and then that did very well. Now that I look back on life, I think, wow, how cool is that? That you could just jump to these different verticals and do these different things and be good at all of them. That takes a certain talent. And you don't know when you're growing up how these impressions impact you, but I can definitely tell that I think observing that had an imprint.
Now that you're doing this trek around the U.S. with your daughter and looking back on that experience with your dad, what is something that you hope your youngest will be able to take with her from this experience living with you on the road?
You're asking some really good questions. Okay. So at the risk that I'm overheard right now, I do worry about the youth today. I worry that the telephone screen absorbs too much of their time and attention. And I worry that they won't have as many sources of real inspiration like we did growing up. And luckily, lately, she has started to ask me questions about the business. And, oh, what does this person do? And what does that person do? Or if I have a tough day, she's like, you know, what's going on? And I actually take the time to explain to her what's going on. And she follows it and she understands it. And then she asks me questions later, really good questions. And so, you know, the fact that she's coming into these meetings with me and scribbling down notes, and I've been shocked at some of the notes. I mean, I walked out of a meeting, with a particular restaurant group, and I looked at her notes, and she's 12, okay? She had written, they're in hyper growth mode and they're having difficulty with their franchisees. You know, we've been talking about these things, and I've been explaining to her all these different concepts. And so as she hears more, she's actually grasping and understanding, and it's amazing to watch. And so to answer your question, I'm hoping that she comes out of these 4 months with an inspiration of what the future might look like and where she might be working toward in the future.
I can say, as someone who spent holidays at my dad's florist when all my friends might be enjoying Thanksgiving with their family sitting down eating, I was cleaning flowers and sweeping floors and freezing. And yeah, you know this story. I was freezing in literal freezers cleaning flowers. And today I looked it back as some of my fondest memories. So I'm sure that she's going to feel the same way, even though, you know, she may not realize just how profound it is yet.
You know what? And it's the small things. Yesterday, we drove from New Orleans to Dallas. It was an 8-hour drive. I was sure that she was going to be up in her bed on her phone watching Young Sheldon or whatever. But no, she sat right next to me you know, looking outside and having good conversation. But here's the cool thing, right? We're watching the countryside as we drive through Louisiana, and we were just chatting about things and we were bonding. And you can't say enough about the importance of that.
Well, that answers my next question, but maybe there's another answer you have to it as well. So I'll still ask it anyway. What is something that's been unexpected from this experience that you've taken away already? I know you still have a long ways to go, but what's something that you've personally learned or taken from this time?
When you do something like this, it's a risk. And there's always something in your mind that asks, is this a good idea? You know, how's this going to go? But you have to just close your eyes and leap off the cliff sometimes. And what has most surprised me in a very positive way is just how well people have responded to this. Bringing a 12-year-old to a conference where it's a business environment, people are, you know, networking, business development, learning from sessions. I don't know how to say this, but the positive energy that came from having a 12-year-old girl mingling with people and having a slight understanding about the business and having real conversations with people. And so I was a little bit nervous going into it. Like, what are people going to think about this? How's it going to be taken? And by day two, people were saying, come to this cocktail party and make sure you bring her. And so it was like, and maybe a part of that is the restaurant industry. The restaurant industry happens to be a very warm, welcoming hospitality industry. But that has to be the most surprising and positive for me personally aspect of this whole thing.
Well, thank you so much, Ashwin. I feel like that's a wonderful note to end on. So thank you for sharing a little bit about your story, a little bit about what you're doing right now, and also kind of some personal insight into you as a father. So I appreciate it.
No problem. It's been a great conversation.